Welcome to Saha Says, where we go over the headlines of the week, sharing our in-the-weeds opinions. Joining us tonight on the program, we have Pinky, the team captain for UTSA's CCDC team, Cooper, who's a biohacker and our news curator, and me, I'm Sciatic Nerd, the B-Sides SATX coordinator and podcast manager. But of course, first, we would like to thank our sponsor, Axion VPN, who delivers a quality solution for your private connection needs. If you or your organization is interested in sponsoring the efforts of Saha or Saha Says, please feel free to reach out to us at hashtag SATXHackers on Twitter. Opening us up this week, we're going to start with Coop, who's got a story from some security researchers. Take it away, Coop.
Yep, looks like it's a businessinsider.in article here. Security experts created fake Wi-Fi networks at the RNC, yes, Republican National Convention, to show how easily attendees could be hacked. Now, I'm assuming it's probably similar to like a Wi-Fi pineapple, but security researchers with Avast software set up a number of fake Wi-Fi networks around the Republican National Convention sites, and not surprisingly, thousands of attendees exposed themselves to the risk of being hacked.
I'm assuming you mean their systems, not the people themselves.
Zip. In a long day, in a day-long experiment, researchers set up open networks with the names like Google Starbucks, I Vote for Trump, Free Internets, and Xfinity Wi-Fi around the Quicken Loans Arena and the Cleveland Airport. More than 1,200 people connected, 70% of whom had their identities exposed. So hackers can easily set up Wi-Fi networks in the hopes that unsuspecting people connect to them. Once online, their web traffic, emails, and other data can be interrupted since the hacker is in control of the network. And that's why we love our sponsor, Axion VPN.
All right, protect your connection, protect your data, folks. And it, to be
don't
clear,
don't be
here,
like the Republicans and drop your pants in public.
Watch it
electronically.
Hey, keep that. Save that stuff for the places where political stuff is shared. We're here to talk about security news and trolling one another. Come on. So,
how about this then?
All right.
How many do you think their passwords for "I love Donald Trump" 123 !! are simply "I love Trump"?
You know, it's possible.
That's my password to TrumpSingles.net.
Wait, TrumpSingles.net? I thought it was .com. Are you going to some kind of honeypot website? You know what? I'm just not sure. These days, I stick to going to places like TakeMyIdentity.com, .co.uk, .DontSpankMe.co. So it's really a safe bet that if you want to give up your data, there are other ways to do it. But I know, again, going back to B-Sides SATX, a young person was actually giving a presentation on the way that people don't pay attention to EULAs. And this is that same kind of experience. People are in a public space and not really thinking about, you know, is this the same mentality you guys think when you go to a concert, right? And so at a concert, you want to upload, you want to take pictures and share your experience of being with that big crowd with other people. I mean, some folks do. That's why they take all these selfies and they upload them. So if your connection wasn't that good, you didn't have a lot of bars in those spaces, Pinky, would you click on an open Wi-Fi hotspot because, hey, it looks like I could get out?
No, I don't, because thanks to hanging out with all you people, I now understand that clicking that means, one, my password's going to get stolen, two, probably my identity, three, my pictures will somehow get stolen off my phone, posted online, none of the fun kinds. I can reassure you that, you perverted listeners.
Come on, you mean you don't want to be a rock star on some revenge porn website?
The only one I
want to FreeBSD want have that on his bucket list?
No, on TrumpSingles.com.
Oh, good golly. Yeah. Again with the Trump singles. Are these like cheese slices, Trump singles? Are they made with a whole 8 ounces of cheese? I don't understand. Look, and what do you mean, you people? What exactly is meant by you people, Pinky? Because I can tell you for sure that all the hackers I know are still people too. So, and I mean people 2.0. You know, not really normal original people. They're extra tasty, crispy people. I don't know. It, it,
I mean, you people who make me have a larger tinfoil hat every time we record this damn podcast. Like, originally started with tinfoil belongs in the kitchen, a place where I'm banned from. And then now it's like, it's occasionally on my head. And now Cooper's sending me links of how to get better ones that hold up better, you know, like with a scarf even, so I can be fashionable out in public. Although I don't know what fashionable means, but supposedly the thing.
Well, okay.
So, yeah, it's starting to sound like we got too much Soylent on our tinfoil here.
Well, that's okay. The tinfoil, I still suggest that the tinfoil, it's basically underoos. It's a Faraday cage for all of your junk, not just the other kind.
So you like to have a Faraday cage and pack safe.
Forget I said that. So back to the story. Really, no, it's not chafing. It's just, I know I don't have a cat. I don't know why you're saying I look like I have scratches on my legs. Go ahead.
That's more than I ever needed to know about you.
Oh, it's true.
Back to the story. Yes, sorry.
So, no, honestly, so, Coop, would you ever actually click on an open? So why wouldn't you click, right? Because Pinky already told us some very good logical reasons not to click on open Wi-Fi. Have you ever actually, right, so there's another very good example of why not to click on an open and apparently free Wi-Fi link. Go ahead and explain.
Well, you know, like I said, it made me wonder if the toy that they used to set it up was just simply a pineapple bought from our good friends at Hack 5. They make lovely, lovely toys
awesome.
For our own education. Or would it be simply something that they, you know, flashed like an older router with DDWRT or OpenWRT and then rolled their own? Because that's what, you know, old versions of the Pi was based on, you know, was OpenWRT and then just adding modules past that to get the full functionality. But now they've got so much more. I don't know what the firmware is anymore.
Go ahead. Sorry.
But it just makes me think, even if you are, you know, connecting to one of these, if you are using a firmware, using a VPN, then all that traffic is encrypted, and all they're getting is a bunch of nonsense anyway, much like anything you would catch at an RNC or Republican National Convention.
Thank you.
Yes.
And so, since we here on this podcast have been have listened to the feedback we've gotten from our public, our listening public, we would like to explain briefly that the Wi-Fi Pineapple is a device sold at Hack Shop. That's HAKSHOP dot myshopify.com. If you just Google, if you just Google Hack Shop, you'll find it. HAKSHOP. And the Wi-Fi Pineapple is described as a comprehensive Wi-Fi auditing device. So at the core of the Wi-Fi Pineapple is what they call their Pine AP or Access Point, which is an advanced suite of wireless penetration testing tools for reconnaissance, man-in-the-middling, tracking, logging, and reporting. So basically, it is an access point, kind of like your home gateway, that actually has multiple antennas on it. And so this way, you'd be able to have a primary network for saying, hey, world, I'm out there. I am an access point that you can connect to. And then a separate radio, a completely separate antenna, so that you can have a second Wi-Fi connection. It creates a very flexible platform from which you can do a bunch of things. And they show things like Wi-Fi man in the middle, meaning you can actually listen in on a conversation. It's kind of like tapping a phone line, but in this case, you're tapping a network wire. Highly effective rogue access point suite of tools, over-the-air apps and modules that can be installed while you're operating the device. You don't have to take it offline to plug things into it to go add new software. And it's really got a neat web interface and all sorts of details. So the Wi-Fi Pineapple is that device, and it's now on its sixth generation, and they've released what they call a Nano Edition. And it's pretty neat. Now, if you go to a certain larger non-regional, I mean, just the big national conferences like your DEF CONs and your ShmooCon and places like that, you can sometimes find these nice folks actually selling their hardware on site, and you can meet some of the folks from their podcast, which is Hack 5. And, of course, you can always find out more about them at hack5.org. Great stuff. So there are some really neat things out there. And if the Pineapple isn't your particular brand of fruit, there are other things like the Pwn Phone and Pwn Pad with its evil access point, which is kind of similar, according to what Coop is sharing right now in our chat room. There are other things. And, Pinky, what was that tangent you wanted to bring up?
So here's an interesting standpoint. So we've now probably scared everyone who's listening to not connect to public Wi-Fi. You know, maybe if you're at university or whatever, you have to, whatever, work, whatever. So let's say you go over to your friend's house.
Yeah.
Do you connect to their Wi-Fi? Exactly, because let's think about this, guys. Some of you might be friends with us. Do you trust us, even if we give you the credentials to our Wi-Fi access network point, you know? What are we going to do with your information?
Well, okay.
So who's to say we don't have an AP on our network and we just give you the credentials to connect to it? That's going to log all your traffic unless you use a VPN.
Well, now, and so while that's all very true, there are advantages. So not every person, not every friend that you connect to or you go to their house is sitting there sniffing your traffic. Now,
they're not?
Not all of them. But on the other hand, there are, exactly, thank you, Coop. So there are separate, ways of doing that. So there's a great actual video presentation from, the Plano Hackerspace folks. They did an entire, presentation on setting up and building your own honeypots. And honeypots are basically a way of setting up a fake access point or what appears to be something neat that you would go and poke around at, but it's actually set up like a trap to get you to come in, and then it starts to walk backwards over your connection to check out who you are and what you're doing. So, I mean, there are a lot of ways you can spend that extra spare time you seem to have, because maybe you're listening to this podcast while you're walking and trying to get in some of those extra steps. But maybe, just maybe, you're using this as the resource it is, and you are actually now going out and you're starting to use your favorite search engine to see if you can download any of that Wi-Fi Pineapple software for alternate platforms. Or are you going out and looking at the Pony, the Pwn Pad, that's PWNPAD, and go look for the Community Edition so you can use it and flash your existing Nexus 5 and Nexus 7 tablets to make use of this toolset? All of these things are available free of charge. Well, the Community Edition software is available free of charge. The Wi-Fi Pineapple and the Wi-Fi Pineapple Nano, those are pay-for items with a strong, strong community following that actually means that you're going to have tools, YouTube videos, all sorts of other resources available, or maybe LiveLeak if you're not a YouTube fan. I realize LiveLeak is a huge next generation open sharing platform. It's basically the YouTube with all the safeties turned off. So be careful if you go searching out there, folks. Always remember to protect yourself and your toys. Coop, what's on your mind?
And definitely keep in mind that Hack5 is not a sponsor of this podcast at this time. We would love them to be in the future because we're just talking about them and praising them so much because we love what they do. Their podcast is top notch. The couple of them that they have, that, you know, plus the Pineapple University, which is a series of videos that they teach you all about their hardware that is just so well done. They've worked on this for so many years. They've been around for over a decade.
Yeah.
And man, these guys really know how to do it. It's just impressive to, you know, if you go back into the archives and see the humble beginnings and, you know, follow it on to where they are now, it's just, wow. They've really worked at it over the years and have done it well. Every time I watch a new episode, I always learn something new. It may or not be, you know, everything that I've always wanted it to be like, but they cover all sorts of topics from drones to hacking to basic stuff like OpenVPN,
yeah,
set up in your home, what have you. They teach you what you need to know and something that interests them, and you can see the love of the technology in the delivery of it all. So I can't say enough about how much I love what they do, but It's something to aspire to, really.
Understandably so. And Pinky, do you have anything you want to throw onto the pyre of thanks that and enjoyment we're heaping upon Hack5 said?
No, just keep up the good work and let us keep having fun.
Thank you guys. And
make
also
more toys.
and I actually also want to make sure we mention that other note that Coop posted here, that Dave Kennedy from TrustedSec has also a really good ways to use these toys as well. And Artillery is the name of the project that he's got out there. So take a look at Artillery, which is also very easy to use and learn from. Lots of material out there on that as well. And of course, you can always look up on YouTube or your favorite streaming materials for DerbyCon, usually for videos about things that Dave Kennedy is up to. So, and the Honeypot Artillery is their Honeypot project. Thank you, Coop. Like in the Plano hacker space, their Honeypot, I think, was honeypot.net, but that's or maybe that's a separate project. Either way, the next story up here is one actually that surprised us from Engadget.com, that the Opera browser has been sold to a Chinese consortium for $600 million. After a $1.2 billion deal fell through, Opera has sold most of itself to a Chinese consortium for around $600 million. The buyer is led by search and security firm Qihu, I'm hoping that's right, Qihu 360, are purchasing Opera's browser business, its privacy and performance apps, its tech licensing, and most importantly, its name. The Norwegian company will keep its consumer division, including Opera apps and games and Opera TV. The consumer arm has 560 workers, but the company hasn't said what will happen to the other 1,109 employees. So the original deal was announced back in February. It failed to gain regulatory approval, and while they were disappointed that that didn't work out, their CEO said that they believe the new deal is very good for Opera employees and shareholders. The acquisition was approved by the board, and now the company has 18 months to find a new name, according to TechCrunch. So, how many of you guys, I'm sure most of us at one point or another, when you had an old candy bar phone or, you used an earlier platform, probably have some experience using Opera. Heck, it was the first browser I ever got working on my old, pre-3G capable cell phone. It was the little Java, Opera Mobile browser, and it was amazing for what it could do on that tiny, tiny little screen. Pinky, did you ever wind up using Opera, and where did you first discover it? Do you recall?
I never used Opera on a mobile phone. I've always had, well, when I went to the smartphone, in America at least, I've always been iPhone, so I never really was all that inclined to go to a different mobile one. But I do remember, gosh, probably back in XP days, maybe, like, I don't know, back when I first started off on the internet as an innocent 12-year-old, I used Opera for whatever weird reason.
Okay, you should never mention the... Redacted.com.
You know, there's some things we don't want to talk about that happened when you were 12.
Stop it. Stop it right now.
I didn't know I knew you when I was 12, but this explains so much now, Cooper. Thank you
for
helping with that missing therapist session I needed in my life.
Okay, Coop, so when did you discover Opera Browser?
Yes, let's keep rolling and avoid the conversation. I think it was like a Symbian phone, probably a Nokia.
Yeah.
At one time, but I remember it being kind of clunky, but everything was clunky back then.
Sure.
That's why, I guess Android and Apple have such a market share in the world these days, because everything else is just second place. I don't remember the line from Small Soldiers. Everything else is just a toy.
Exactly. There you go. So I have to admit that Opera browser has always had its place, and I used to work with a gentleman who that was his primary browser choice was Opera. And I said, why would you choose that over Firefox? And this person always had a separate view of things, a separate take of things. And according to this person, they always released very frequent updates and security patches. I said, well, that's interesting. So Opera 10, which was the one that they were up to at the time, I think it was, they were always pushing in new updates, he said. I said, I still don't see it. But then again, they also described to me that they didn't need all 10 fingers to type. All they ever needed were these, and they would be indicating their two index fingers to type. And they would type the most elaborate, this person would type the most elaborate emails at a very steady pace. But they were accurate. It just wasn't fast. So, whatever that's worth, I guess we should probably, instead move on from our days of reminiscing about Opera and instead consider.
Could it be worth $600 million, though?
Well, because I think they probably have some patents that are out there.
Yeah, the patents must be, because it's like you think of Opera and it doesn't have a good, user market probably now.
It's still the fifth most popular desktop browser. Only has 1.9% share, but it does hold a respectable 10% of the mobile market. Because if you don't have a smartphone, you're probably using the Opera browser.
Well, wasn't it like 1.2 billion that they originally had their sale price set at?
Yeah.
That almost went through. Then it went down to 600 mil. Were they a part of Prime Days? You know, Black Friday and July sales or what?
Oh, come on. Yeah.
Lightning
that's
sale.
That's like
half price.
Wow.
Well, 50 off. Opera browser.
Oh, my gosh. That's rough. Yeah, if you're a consortium, you got to catch them all. No. And actually, so what they were saying, the company's been especially innovative in this arena of the mobile market, having introduced built-in ad blocking, data and video compression, and a built-in VPN connection.
You know, you're actually right. So FreeBSD actually did use Opera, I think, very briefly because it had built-in, you know, ad blockers for the mobile phone before they introduced whitelisting and whatnot for the iPhone and all that. So kudos to them for that. It's just maybe too little too late for them.
Mm, nobody wants to use Safari.
Hey, I love Safari, man.
So
that explains a lot.
Oh, hey now. Now, before we get into a different kind of political argument, let's talk about something so embarrassing it makes a great story, like the fact that there's no more porn with your Starbucks latte. Apparently, a story that comes to us from Ars Technica, from their policy page, actually says that Starbucks says Friday it would soon add porn blocking filters to its public in-store Wi-Fi. The move follows McDonald's, which disclosed this week that it had blocked the hamburger eating public from accessing Wi-Fi enabled porn at their restaurants. The quote says, "Once we determine that our customers can access our free Wi-Fi in a way that also doesn't involuntarily block unintended content, we'll implement this in our stores." Now, this was Starbucks saying that in a statement. "In the meantime, we reserve the right to stop any behavior that interferes with our customers' experience, including what is accessed on our free Wi-Fi." Wow. So, I guess.
Why else am I going to go to Starbucks now, man? Come on. You don't go there for the overpriced coffee.
But wait, what are you doing in public in a booth? you know what? Don't answer that. Don't answer that. I don't want to know.
I don't know if that's G-rated, sir.
Well, this podcast is rapidly devolving as we talk about. So the fact that that even made the news this week just kind of concerns me a little bit. Instead, I'd rather talk about something from Naked Security. Actually, no. So nakedsecurity.sophos.com. Hey, I'm not the one who writes this stuff, people. Sometimes the jokes write themselves. NakedSecurity.sophos.com. The headline reads, "DARPA Stages an AI Hacking Tournament at DEF CON in Black Hat." And this is coming up right around the corner. No offense, human cybersecurity workers, but you are much too slow. That's the first line of the article by Lisa Voss. DARPA says that in the time it takes to identify new flaws and threats and patch them up, a process that can take over a year, miscreants can further exploit them. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, better known as DARPA, wants us to speed it up and grab back that time advantage by moving to automated defenses, machines that can discover, prove, and fix software flaws in real time without any assistance. And they're putting their money where its mouth is, because they're billing this as the world's first all-machine hacking tournament. The historic battle. Two men enter, one man leave. I don't know what you're saying there. It's some kind of Thunderdome for cybersecurity systems. And basically, it's going to be at the DARPA's Cyber Grand Challenge. The finals are going to be in the middle of the two big conferences. It's not Panoply either. It's a little different. But I'm definitely excited about it. And, oh, by the way, if you're going to be at Black Hat, it is free to enter Panoply. And you know what? I believe that Pinky actually has better information on it.
So I only know about this primarily because while CCDC primarily is a, blue team only event, there's the little sister project of Panoply that is run by this CIAS, where it's a pure red teaming activity, and unlike a lot of CTFs, which are more Jeopardy style, you actually get to go pwn a box. So it's an actual activity where you get to test out your red team skills, you break into a computer, you secure it, and you get scored that way. So it's free to enter, might as well participate if you're already at Black Hat. And if you're not able to go to Black Hat, remember that there's still time to register for the Trend Micro CTF that's happening this coming up weekend.
So do you know where Panoply is supposed to be taking place, or should they just probably use a search engine and look up Panoply at Black Hat?
They should probably just look it up. I don't know if they fully announced it yet. I just remember seeing Jess retweeting about it.
Nice. So if you're not already doing one CTF, you can sign up for another CTF while you're thinking about more CTF. Good. Sharpen
Sounds
those
like
skills.
Fun.
And by the way, just to make mention of it, to round it out, the 4th of August is when the Cyber Grand Challenge Finals will take place. So if you're ready to go watch a very strange battle that I don't know what that's going to look like. I mean, it's not like you're going to see people sweating in front of computer monitors. I mean, it's just automated systems beating the crap out of each other, which I'm sure is awesome if you were, you know, Tron or Kevin Flynn and you're in the Matrix or in the grid. I mean, I'm sure it would look great, but I don't know how else we're going to see. Anybody got any ideas? I'm very curious. Anyway, so it's, yes, not at Starbucks, Coop, because they'll be blocking that. Yes, because machines will be overexcited and looking. That's machine porn. That's different.
Well, you know, machines learning, you know, becoming more like humans. Let's just use all the terminology wrong and just go with the fact that they'll become like humans. And, you know, we'll go through I Am Robot. And instead of taking over humanity, they take over all the porn. There you go.
Taking over all the porn. We'll see that.
Skynet's revenge. What?
Well, actually, it's not Skynet's revenge. It may be federal grant revenge, which actually might support UTSA or something, the really terrible segue that I'm offering to Pinky.
That is a terrible segue, but we'll go with it. So, thanks, Coop, for throwing this at me. But in the news just earlier this week was federal grant supports UTSA research in espionage prevention. The professor I'm studying under, Dr. Nicole Beebe, who's the director of the Center for Education and Research in Information and Infrastructure Security, what a mouthful, at UTSA is partnering up with Dr. Koh, who's a professor of Management Science and Statistics, have just received a $649,172 grant from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to strengthen insider threat detection. So if you've heard of Dr. Beebe at all lately, which maybe, maybe not if you stalk UTSA, she's been really, for the last few years, have been researching different ways to help find the insider threats, especially after, you know, Edward Snowden. Regardless of your thoughts about it, it's a great research and funding opportunity from the federal government.
Sure.
So this way, because it's statistical, you can think about it the same way as viruses, you know, everything are probably, let's say, 90% of how things work today is signature-based. We look for something that's already happened before, we create some sort of hash for it, and we say, if this matches, like an executable, then it's this virus and it's bad, alert and get rid of it. Similarly, we can do the same for, you know, profiling or whatever when we're doing interviews.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole point here is to look at your network traffic or your forensic, you know, data on a computer, you know, an endpoint system, and try to figure out the outliers of, hey, this person is, you know, saving, you know, a whole bunch of PDFs when normally they never have done so. You know, this mm-hmm. person who's technologically incompetent is now saving 100 Word documents daily. This is weird. Why is this the case? And that's what her research is really going into, looking at the outliers, looking at, you know, behavioral activity and being like, why is this different? Alert, you know, is this to be concerned that they get a new job role or are they starting, you know, some sort of insider threat?
And see, that's actually a really interesting thing to watch. Now, if you're not familiar, UTSA is the University of Texas at San Antonio. I graduated from there, as I'm sure several of people who listen to this podcast have probably passed through there at one time or another. And that's where, of course, Pinky's CCDC team is connected to. Now, the other interesting thing is that the person or the group that is actually developing a software system to analyze all this data, according to this article, is actually from another local group. If you've ever heard of the CyberDef Dojo, that's actually an extension of DefLogix. So they've got their own meetup page. If you're looking to get into computer learning about computer security and about programming, that's a good group to go and learn about. If Saha is not quite the same speed of the interest that you have. So where Saha, it takes more of a focus on, different types of computer security. It's definitely, it's not, you know, to each their own. Everyone's got their own speed. So it seems like basically Saha can occasionally feel like you're drinking from the fire hose. I've been told by other people. But that's okay. If you want to jump in or just kind of sit on the sidelines and kind of absorb and put your toes in and get your feet wet, Sometimes it just takes all kinds. And when it takes all kinds, it takes different speeds. So consider checking out the guys from CyberDef Dojo as well as Saha itself, which meets on a different day. So there's definitely enough time in your schedule, hopefully, to catch all of the data you want and to learn from it. Now, I think this, personally is a fascinating project, that UTSA is getting involved in. And, I do hope that that this continues, to actually strengthen, the insider threat detection as the article states it's supposed to. I think that would be very interesting to build those larger patterns. And I'm very curious to know what the false positive rate on something like this is, right? Because maybe you don't always go digging in and save off those unique PDFs like the article mentioned. Maybe you just catch a thread of something, and how do people use that? How do you learn about those patterns? Maybe this ties back to the earlier article. Coop, Pinky, what do you think? Do you think this ties back to those public Wi-Fi, connections you gotta be careful about connecting to, because maybe that's what's happening in that monitoring situation, is that that traffic isn't necessarily being blocked, it's being watched.
Yeah, it really is more of an alert system, especially due to the fact that it's, you know, so groundbreaking. And again, the false positive is something I know she's being concerned about. So it's an alert, and it's still going to always require someone who's human who has that insight that a machine, it's really hard to replicate that inside knowledge of, is this normal or is it not? So again, maybe it also comes back down to the Starbucks porn blocking of this website. Sounds weird. Should you actually block it?
Well, you can also think about the fact that you're talking about false positive with firewalls, what have you. It then not just false positive, but you can also miss things because people pad their packets and slip it on through. You get, you know, stable, good data in front of their injection, and it passes through the firewall, no big deal. I actually had that conversation while driving back with a buddy from AHA, from NetWars, last Friday. And we had a big discussion because that's what he's working on, is a lot of dealing with false positives and also false negatives of packets getting through because they are padded.
Actually, could we stop for a minute? I would love to hear, Coop, your experience with NetWars and what it was like, if you could walk us through, because basically this is the first time that I've heard people really talk about. So let me backfill you here. So at B-Sides SATX back in May, Coop was one of the recipients. He won from the raffle. He won an access pass to NetWars. So can you walk us through what that gave you access to and what your experience was like? Because I understand it's, what, 2 days?
Yeah, it's two evenings, and it's basically like a CTF tournament put on by SANS as almost like a capstone of applying what most people are there have been taking a SANS course all week. And then there's a few of us lucky guys that got passes to come in and do NetWars with the students. And then whoever wins, whether it be the first place team or like the top five solos, then get to go on to their tournament of champions, as they put it, in Washington, D.C. Now, I was lucky to be on a team of very gifted individuals. One was RJ Mendez, and the other was Frozen Fox. Frozen Fox, we've heard talked about him before. Cultivator, creator of Hack Doom, which is a project in process. Guy's a freaking genius and DevOps god of sorts. Then RJ and I were basically trying to be as useful as we could. First day was basic Linux commands in a VM. That was first level. Second level was going through deeper into that and rooting it and then exploiting further on. Then the third level, that's when two of us kind of stalled out going, oh man, we should have paid more attention, because the previous weekend we had had a web app penetration with Metasploit, both beginning and advanced class with Brandon Perry, who's another guy from AHA, and he was putting on a weekend of training free to the open public to basically advertise his training courses that he sells. And it was amazing, but we just didn't have enough time to let it soak in, you might say. But, you know, if we would have had that and then maybe paid a little bit more attention to some talks that J-Duck talked about, different Android stuff, then we would have done better. But it was kind of neat to see how Black Owl, another guy from AHA area, just destroy everything. He got first in the solos group. My team, we got second in the group competition, but we led it most of the time, and at the very end, it just caught up with us, the fact that there's some more stuff we need to do in our own learning. And, you know, I can definitely say I felt a lot more useful the first day as a teammate. The second day was just like, oh God.
But you're still learning. I mean, the fact that, you know, now that's literally from the fire hose. That's an immersive experience.
Uh-huh. And it makes me hooked now. Before in the past, I've tried different CTFs and never really got into it, never stayed the full time. This time I actually, you know, since it was such an opportunity, was forced to stay from beginning to end. And now I can definitely say I'm an addict. I'm hooked.
Awesome.
I'm going to be looking at Walleye Mountain Hacker Summer Camp with y'all next week. Sorry, we won't be here to record next week. But if you find us out there, maybe we can record a interview, what have you, if you so desire. Get some sort of informal thing and record that. But you might be lucky to find me and pull me out of a CTF. That's all I'm saying.
Actually, you can probably find Coop hanging out at the Biohacking Village, I would imagine.
Possibly, but I'm going to explore that. But I think more when I'm not talking at B-Sides, I'm going to be trying to see what CTFs are running and see what else I can learn.
And by the
because
way,
it's just when you're actually learning and by doing it, everything just makes so much more sense.
Well, and that's actually so one of the episodes I have not yet released for the Security Endeavors podcast is actually a full-blown long-form interview with Forgotten Sec. Now, if you haven't actually met Forgotten Sec, if you know who Forgotten is, he's pretty in-depth, thorough guy, pretty awesome. He's helped contribute quite a lot to CTF Wiki. So if you're going to go to a regional wiki and it's a standing invitation kind of thing, if you're going to a CTF that has been posted before or is operated before and they haven't done a lot of updates, and even if they have, it's worthwhile to look up CTF Wiki and see what information is in there. There's so much TTP in CTF Wiki for understanding methods. It's really awesome. So good stuff. But if you're on a CCDC team, keep sharpening those skills. If you're a CTF player, man, I mean, that's what CTF is all about, is sharpening that skill set, isn't it? Or am I misunderstanding that, Pinky? Why do people play CTFs?
No, you're completely right, especially when you can get a CTF to be a bit more than just the typical Jeopardy style. You get people interested, and especially from people who maybe aren't more new to the industry, like students just entering the career field, what have you. You finally get to apply some knowledge that you're learning on your day-to-day lives and be like, wow, shit, I know, you know, nothing. And then you get to start figuring out, how do you get into a system? How do you maintain persistence? How do you find other people? How do services actually work? So when you visit a website and you get maybe an error or things are going slow, you start realizing, you're discovering, you know, you think of different ways. You're like, wow, this website's loading slow. Is it a configuration problem? Are they being DOS? Is it my end? You know? You start thinking a lot more than just being frustrated on your day-to-day lives. And then when you do maybe poorly or not number one or whatever with a CTF, you get, you know, that urge to do better every year. And even if you are number one, you want to maintain your title. So it becomes, you know, a mixture of reputation, maybe masochism, I don't know.
Oh, masochism. Okay, I don't know about that.
Isn't that all learning? A little bit of masochism in your learning? talking about Jeopardy-style CTFs, that's also one other thing that's very interesting about NetWars. I wasn't able to get that far along this time, but I'm looking forward to it in the future. If you get to the higher levels in it, then there is a little bit of P versus P. That it's nice that they save that for the end, for the higher levels, because, you know, if you're good enough to get to level 5 or level 6 in it, then it's a lot more let's smack each other around bit to then prevent someone from, you know, winning, you might say. Much unlike, you know, the normal recon-style CTF that you see. So, that's also why, you know, you keep talking about CCBC. It definitely makes me very interested, and I'm sure you as well, one day being good enough to be asked to volunteer for Red Team, because then you get all the fun of the P versus P and make those kitties cry. but you gotta cry first before you can make someone cry, apparently.
Gotta pay your dues.
Indeed. Gotta learn it. Gotta learn it and feel the pain.
You don't have to do blue in order to be on Red Team. It just helps. They really love when, because I've talked to, you know, like Script Junkie, and they really love when they get an ex-competitor who's Red Team, because then you understand both mindsets. You're not just pure, I wonder what will make them cry. You're like, no, you assholes did this to me before, now let's add a little bit extra.
And then you get to sit there and watch them giggle while they're doing it, too, I bet.
Oh, God.
Be like, and then you get the
you're the one, I hate you.
Yeah, I've had that conversation already a few times.
Well, that wraps up our version of the news, which pushes us into the next piece, the Hacks of the Week. And opening all around, the opening salvo comes from Pinky. Take it away.
So we got some two interesting articles right now. The first one's from ArsTechnica.com, and it's warning you that as you're on your quest to catch them all, be a little bit careful if you haven't already installed it, especially if you're on an Android, because fake Pokemon Go app on Google Play infects phones with a screen locker.
Oh.
And one of these has a nice, lovely video for me. That's fantastic.
Oh, no.
So sorry about that. There we go. So, I've already seen this pop up a few times, but now apparently the issue is that we're now at maybe 3 or 4 copies of Pokemon Go on the Google Play Store. And some of them are getting so persistent that it requires you to remove your battery or use Device Manager to uninstall it. So it's not as simple as your typical uninstall your app. It's deep in there now.
So how do I'm curious if you guys, okay, so I would like to believe that when I am using my phone, I am going to look for the actual app that I want, whether it's a communications app, a game app. But okay, so how would this thing confuse me into loading the wrong one? How would I get tricked into grabbing the fake one that is kind of a ransomware thing?
I think that what's really going to come down to is not, if you went onto the Google Play Store and you went to find it, I think you'd find the correct one just because it's so much more popular. You know, there's already been reports that saying Pokemon Go is the most widely used app. It's already beat Twitter, Grindr, all of those. But I think it's more when you get an ad on your phone and it says, hey, do you want to download Pokemon Go? You know, maybe you see an advertisement, you click it, and it brings you to the malicious one rather than the true one or things like that. Or you misclick, whatever.
Gotcha.
Same thing with phishing.
Sure. I mean, all it takes is that one wrong tap, sadly, and you've added something that you didn't mean to. And then your phone catches it all, and sadly.
Well, it's, you know, using proper DCS. Don't click shit. Yeah. If you're dumb enough to not choose the right publisher, then you're going to get screwed. And also, you know, there's all these apps that say, you know, like hints or strategies for different games. And if you're stupid enough to click those too, sometimes you're just getting malware along with some stupid stuff to say how you can perform better at this game. Blah, blah, blah. Same thing happened with Flappy Bird, especially when it got yanked off everything when the software developer said, screw it, I'm out. You know, I'm making too much money off of this stuff. And all of a sudden, all these clones popped up saying,
sure,
Flappy Bird this, that, and there. And what were they? Malware in your phone. You know, cyber herpes, as you would.
Cyber herpes. Is it like ice pirates and space herpes?
Let's hope not, because, you know, if you remember that movie well, you've got the whole metal mouth at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
I don't want to see that coming anywhere near me.
No.
If you don't know what that means, that, and you're listening to this podcast, then please watch the movie and laugh.
Yeah, it's got about 4 minutes of terrible, actionable, funny content. Funny. So you're going to lose an hour and a half of your life. You will laugh and cringe for about 4.5 minutes. But the scarring, the scarring is forever. So,
so going back to the article real fast, then another way, tying back into your question of why people download it, is that one of the malware is apparently called Guide and Cheats for Pokemon Go, so the people who are addicted and want help, maybe, that's how they also get it. And there's another one where, for whatever reason, it's called Install Pokemon Go. People closely. But both of these apps deliver ads carrying fraudulent, scary-sounding messages that are designed to trick users into buying expensive, unnecessary services. One such message will claim that your device is infected with malware and prompt the user to spend money to get the malicious apps removed. And every time the user clicks the back button, new scareware pops up and more advertisements appear. And the only way to get rid of them is to double-click on the back button, apparently.
Oh, how strange.
Yeah.
Oh, weird. So, all right, so have any of you, because I know I think I only had one, it was a flashlight app that I downloaded once for a phone that turned out to be trying to do strange things. But aside from that phone app, the flashlight app, I haven't had that much experience with this. Have either of you, let's start with Coop, have you ever accidentally wound up with an app that you shouldn't have had?
Well, unfortunately, when I carried a Windows mobile phone for a little bit, majority of the few apps that were in that app store was basically adware.
Really?
Yeah, because it, all it did was almost nothing and pop up ads constantly. So to me, it's just ad-supported crap, and very bad DCS to have that type of phone. It was fun if you stuck with the straight operating system, but as soon as you started exploring the red light district of a app store, you just fell down a downward spiral, you might say.
I'm a little concerned about the red light district in any app store. I'm just saying. However, I did actually own and happily own for about 2 years. I did have a Windows phone that worked pretty dang well, as Coop says, if you stick to the straight and narrow apps. If you're using Office tools and you're using Skype and all that kind of stuff, or even just straight email, it's fine. Where it just unfortunately just did not have enough other apps to round out. You know, all the cool kids had Instagram and you did not. And so you're like, what's something else that's not called Instagram, but it does kind of the thing, but I can't post. So what good is that? It's a poorly rendered web view of the site with ads at the bottom. I know what Coop's talking about. I loved Windows Mobile or Windows Phone 8. I did, because Cortana was awesome. It's just that they're missing some other apps and they couldn't get the developing community to kind of catch. So anyway, how about you, Pinky? Have you ever you said you're mostly on the iPhone. Have you run into apps you discover later that you didn't mean to download?
Well, you see, unlike you silly people, I actually look carefully where I install. No, I'm joking. No, I've tried downloading, I'm trying to think. There's this grocery list app that I have, and I've found I'm particularly picky about my grocery list apps, apparently. And the only one I have that's any worthwhile has ads, because, of course, I don't believe in buying it, because you're just a stupid grocery list app, whatever. And some days it wants to crash all day, and it just keeps playing fucking ads over my grocery list. I'm at HEB trying to buy groceries, and it decides to have a glitchy day and does that. But do I actually have my phone for any malware, adware, any of that per se? Probably not.
Interesting. Probably. So you're saying that you don't believe in paying for things. I understand. No, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
Use our groceries on iOS?
She didn't say which one. I think she did that on purpose. Yeah.
Because that's one I use, and it's not a whole lot of pop-ups, but it does have a little bit of an ad bar, but it works pretty lovely.
I use Listies because I want to be able to check it off like you actually do on a physical one.
Sure.
There's something that's pleasing about that to me. I'm picky. And it mainly only has ads on the bottoms, but for like this one release cycle, it would actually pop up and it was annoying as hell.
Mm.
And then they fixed it, I guess, with enough complaints.
Because I remember I had some friends who were using Don't Forget the Milk, which is supposed to be good because it allowed for updating. So if someone else, if you guys shared, I guess, a login or something, I'm not sure how it worked, they could, a distant other person could add something to the list. So it sounded neat, but I've never actually used it. But okay. Well, you know, when you're not trying to figure out which fake apps to avoid, it turns out where we've seen articles before that talk about other ways to trick us into submitting our ATM with strip readers and, you know, where the people just put these overlays on top of machines. Now it turns out that according to darkreading.com, there's an article that talks about crooks hacking Taiwanese ATMs with smartphones without even using a bank card, and they're stealing millions. So, hackers believed, now this is the article that says, hackers believed to be Russian nationals stole around $2.2 million worth from ATMs in Taiwan, possibly using just their smartphones, and then fled the country the following day, reports the Register, quoting Taiwanese police. So, 42 people heard, familiar with the matter. security camera footage shows the crooks used a connected device, but no bank card, to work several ATM machines of First Bank, say the police. So there's a firm Tripwire, and one of the people from there says that it was likely that First Bank, the hackers who hacked the First Bank, had installed malware ahead of time, enabling a wireless connection to jackpot the ATMs. Three malware strains reportedly showed up on the breached machines, and he believes a weak wireless service could also allow hackers to access ATMs. And supposedly, several banks in Taiwan have suspended their ATM operations while investigations continue. Now, if you have ever seen, if you've been going through an airport and you've seen one of these standalone displays that just eventually crashes, you've seen the blue screen of death out there and you've seen them posted on the internet, and you come to find out that some of these older embedded systems, or rather, some of these older systems are running an embedded version of Windows XP. That includes some older ATM devices. So, yes, now that you really do want those Faraday cage underoos I was talking about earlier, no, you can't find them on Amazon. No, I'm not asking you to ship me a 50-gallon drum of lube either. I'm saying that there's actually a... I know, I took the left turn on that on purpose to see who's awake and who's listening. Keep your 50-gallon drum of lube to yourself. Look, so what I'm saying is that while you cannot find a simple way to overcome these older systems by replacing their operating systems, you can find them in the wild, sadly, sometimes. It's a problem. And the real challenge is, okay, so how many of these older systems are still running XP under the hood? And how can you find out? And do you just want to avoid using those ATMs? Which, by the way, PSA, public service announcement, be very, very careful. Pinky just got through telling us, and so did Coop reminding us, that you shouldn't just randomly click things if you're not sure if it's the right one or not, especially in an app store. This goes doubly so for the ATMs in Las Vegas in the first week of August. And I'm not kidding. So, don't put it past a bunch of very creative security professionals to maybe want to discover who's willing to stick their cards in untested machinery. So be very careful and make sure the ATM you're about to use is real. And what that really means is if it looks genericized, if it doesn't actually state what bank it's connected to, if you can't tell what company supports it, maybe it's a good idea to check with the hotel management before putting your card in there. There have been more than a couple of situations where rando ATMs have shown up around DEF CON. Also, the same goes for your cell phone. Now, obviously, if you're a regular attendee of DEF CON, you know, do not bring your cell phone in anything but airplane mode. Heck, better still, the only way to be safe, take the battery out and tuck it under the bed in the hotel. Really, hit it with a hammer. No, don't hit it with a hammer. But I'm saying, otherwise, it's very likely you wind up on the Wi-Fi wall of sheep. And don't do this. Don't get there. Don't get caught. Don't get stuck. Don't click crap. Don't stick anything in anything else. Don't stick your card in crazy. That's what I'm saying. Be careful.
And also make sure you have a good, you know, credit union or bank, whatever, that has a nice policy about fraudulent charges, because God knows you're probably, if you're going to be dumb, And, you know, you're going to be like, hey, I'm not going to use my debit card, so I'm protected, but someone still gets a hold of your credit card. Make sure you can at least be like, hey, sorry, I was at this hacker con and someone stole my identity while I was there.
Because that's exactly what will happen, people. They are there, they're having fun, this is them blowing off steam, and let them not blow off your steam. So, protect your stuff.
Or let them.
Or let them, if you're really in a giving mood. That's your business.
Yeah, that's one I definitely think of. Traveler's checks, prepaid credit cards, leave everything at home, have a con phone, what have you, without your personal stuff attached to it. Don't leave anything in the hotel room because, yes, these are hackers. These are lock pickers. These are guys that can break into shit and then see what you have. I'm pretty sure we've heard some stories of somebody breaking into another person's room and looking through all their stuff. And I remember, at a certain con locally, someone complaining about that and just going, I don't want to leave anything anywhere anymore. Can't trust these fuckers.
Well,
end quote.
End quote.
And at that point, it's like, yeah, take only what you can carry and don't leave it anywhere. Have it in a good bag that can't be scanned, can't be taken off you easily. You know, I personally have been told, like, PackSafe is a good brand to get as far as, like, sling bag or a backpack, because they've got cable, high-quality cable woven into the straps so that your straps can't be just simply ripped off your body very easily and run off with your stuff.
Interesting. Go ahead.
And also has the Faraday pockets to where they can't be scanned. Hmm. You know, if you happen to forget and bring your chipped cards with you, stick it in the Faraday bag, please, the pockets. You know, borrow sciatic nerds underoos that are Faraday cages for, his parts. Stick your cards in there, stick it in your regular bag if you have to, but protect yourself. For the love of all that is holy, protect yourself.
And don't leave shit in your back pocket.
Instead of licking shit, don't leave shit out and available for people to have fun with. Otherwise, you will become a part of the wall of sheep in some way, form, or fashion.
You think that I'm wearing... So I started wearing the vest originally. If you've ever seen, met me, whatever, you know I wear a vest all the time, and that vest is loaded down with way too much stuff. But this started as in photography school and just kept going as I remember watching Doctor Who as a kid, and he carried everything on him. So basically, he is kind of a vagabond mode of operation, but you were very nomadic. You could go anywhere and your stuff is basically with you. And so the worst thing ever is someone saying, all right, empty all your pockets, because you will be there a while. However, there are reasons for the ways I do some of these things. And as opposed to, all right, don't carry anything. Please don't try to set up dead drops to pay for your hotel room. There are some things you have to do like a regular person. And one of those things is probably have at least one card. But yes, you can safely increase your level of security without putting on the underoos. You can save yourself some trouble by using the little paper sleeves that are the foil sleeves that are very inexpensive and can protect at least one or two different types against one or two different types of RFID scamming or skimming to protect yourself. You could actually just use tinfoil if you want, not for your underoos, but for your cards. Well, maybe for your underoos, that's your business. I'm not here to judge. I'm just offering a suggestion that if you can protect yourself in a simple way that does not further impede you getting ready in the morning and going out to do normal things, you should probably consider doing that.
And also be careful of the, social engineers. You know, hackers are no longer what Hollywood wants you to perceive as the people who only live in their mother's basements and, are obvious to spy in a crowd. There's going to be social engineering people. You're going to become their next talk at their local, hacker meetup like Zaha for when you fall into whatever scheme. So the gist of all this is use protection.
Nice. Speaking of people who could have used some protection, Coop, why don't you talk about virtual reality software?
Indeed, we can. With this ArsTechnica.com article, and apparently it's time to batten down the hatches because Navy has been accused of pirating 585 1,000 copies of VR software.
That's a lot of software.
Yep.
I don't know if I believe it.
Apparently, an article here says that in 2011 and 2012, Bit Management agreed to license its software to the Navy on a limited and experimental basis. Those individual PC-based licenses authorities the Navy to install VS Contact Geo on a total of just 38 computers for the purpose of testing, trial runs, and integration into Navy systems. In order to facilitate such testing and integration of the software on Navy computers in preparation for the large-scale licensing desired by the Navy, it was necessary for Bit Management to remove the control mechanism that tracked and limited the use of the software. So based on the quality and performance of the VS Contact Geo, including the interactive functionality and high-quality graphics, it made it particularly useful to large military organizations, the Navy determined that it would deploy the software on a large scale and began negotiations with Bit Management for the purpose of numerous additional licenses. While those negotiations were ongoing, however, and without Bit Management's advanced knowledge or consent, the Navy installed VS Contact Geo software onto hundreds of thousands of computers. Bit Management did not license or otherwise authorize these uses of its software, and the Navy has never compensated Bit Management for these uses of Bit Management software.
See, but the thing is, when we look at the just beyond that line in the story, it says the lawsuit alleges that a Navy procurement official informed the company that they planned on installing the software on the larger number of computers, but while the negotiations were ongoing, it suggests that the person had said the Navy was also at the same time copying and installing the software without authorization on a very large scale. So it's interesting and very scary to think that they would just go for it and say, sure, we're just going to go and use it. It just sounds like the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. Do you agree or disagree, Pinky?
I agree. It's just this is a case of poorly handled, maybe rogue person, you know? They think, oh, we're going to get this anyway, so let's maybe just get ahead. And, you know, it's going to take forever and a day to install 500,000 copies, you know, if they were actually planning on that much.
Right.
So maybe let's go ahead, roll it out, make sure it's going to work, and work on, you know, the more sysadmin side of problems. You know, is it going to install correctly? Do we need to push it out? Is there any updates? Blah, blah, blah. And they just did so a bit too early, maybe?
And you know what? Maybe so. Maybe so. Because, I mean, I know that it's not always easy to get things through from point A to point B. In other words, get approvals to get things done. That's any large organization, especially an organization as large as a governmental-related one. However, the challenge remains that when we have, you know, like was just said, it takes a while to install 500,000 of anything. It's not like you can just knock it over there. Coop, I mean, you've worked with large organizations, right? I mean, heck, small organizations. How quickly do things move?
Just as quickly as a glacier.
Right.
That's why, going back to the article, it, you know, didn't surprise me. They said that the government did not immediately respond for comment. But also later down, it says, you know, Sue says that the software has been deployed on at least, you know, the big number computers, but it is likely that its unauthorized copying has taken place on an even larger scale. So their numbers are not fully, you know, there yet. It's just an estimate. So it's kind of scary.
Yeah.
Just makes me wonder, you know, in future articles, where all the dust will settle on this one.
Very, very good point. And that actually wraps the hacks of the week, which leads us straight down into the underbelly, into the seedy underbelly of Gadget Prod. I wonder what we're going to find.
This is probably going to disappoint both of you with that intro. But let's just go with this of These clothes can wirelessly charge your phone. And this is from money.cnn.com. Unfortunately, no, we are not talking about underwear. You cannot charge your phone with your penis yet.
Whoa. We were talking about clothing a second ago. How did we get to junk charging junk? Okay, never mind. Just
because Starbucks blocked it, that's why.
Oh, you know, thank you, Starbucks.
People using junk to unlock video purposes.
Stop. Right. See, that's what we get for watching the internet. You know what? Let's let Pinky read this article.
Makes me wonder if fingerprint scanner works that way.
Mental image. Bringing it back. So, apparently someone already started, I would say the name, but I'm gonna, you know, not pronounce it correctly, so we're just gonna stick with the company of the Bobax jacket. Was originally on Kickstarter less than a year ago and raised a whopping $9.2 million, and he's now debuting his next project, clothes that wirelessly charge your devices. And this is aimed to, you know, Apple or Android or whatever.
Wow.
It includes Apple Watches, this, you know, I think there's also mention of the Samsung smartwatch as well. And basically they're turning jackets, jeans, and shorts into mobile charging stations. And the clothing, which is machine washable, has copper wire built into it and a wireless charging pad that's stitched inside a pocket. For the Android phones that support the wireless charging, you know, some of them are starting that, you can just stick it into an area that has the charging station. Otherwise, if you're like me and you have an iPhone, there's a part where you can just have your charger and you plug it in there.
Oh, that's interesting.
The battery bank can support up to one full charge for a smartphone, two charges for a smartwatch, and four to Bluetooth earphones. Can I suggest not bringing this to DEF CON?
Yeah, right?
That would be a bad thing to have at a pool party.
Yes.
And also, it sounds like you would need Sciatics Vest to carry all the different adapters for your different electronics that you could charge with this thing.
So. Well, it looks like it's trying to have most of it built in. For example, the color in each jacket also provides a plug-in point to charge wireless earbuds. A separate charging unit inside the jacket sleeve can charge an Apple Watch.
Wow. Ish. So now I will admit that I roll with Scott eVest everywhere I go, and though they're not a sponsor of this podcast, but we're open to it. The Scott eVest has all the pre-wired, has all the routing points, so you can hide wires in and throughout the vest, which I find fantastic, but it allows me to also unwire the vest if I need to wash it. Well, when I need to wash it. Because, yes, I mean, once all your stuff's in there, it's kind of like, well, why would I change that? It's all working right now. But the reality is that I've got to wash it from time to time, usually not by jumping in the pool. Yes, hey, the vest does not smell
Please
this week.
Wash it.
I do wash the vest. I do wash. I'm fastidious.
Once every 6 months?
Whether it needs it or not.
That's awful. We all sniff him to see if the vest is washed.
So if you do not sniff my vest, that is not. I am not your flower. Don't approach me and randomly start sniffing me. But thank you for offering. And no. So
he'll be right.
Wow. Best offer I've had all podcast. Okay. Terrific. So. No,
now to go further.
But the question really becomes, okay, so if you had a vest or an article of clothing that can charge something else, so does it have a built-in battery? And if so, I mean, can you provide your own? Would it be easier if I could, right? So maybe you want to supply, one of the smaller, lighter weight power supplies, or maybe you just want something that's the size of a VHS cassette that could charge an iPad while you're walking around. It's all your business, right? So, what's the largest battery you've ever carried, and how many devices were you attempting to charge simultaneously? Pinky, go.
I'm a weird one where I normally don't carry batteries. I just carry all my chargers and add, you know, the extra 20 pounds to my backpack then, and then make FreeBSD carry it, so I don't care.
Nice.
So, you know, I'm a great person like that. Oh, Coop, what are you showing off?
What is that?
This is a 20,000 mAh.
Wow.
Yeah,
and that is the size of a VHS tape almost.
I think I've had a computer smaller than it before.
Now, it's thinner than a computer, but I mean, it's about the thickness
of a... It's almost the same size as like a Sony Vaio that I still want, even though it's just an Atom with 2 gig of RAM. And the Sony Vaio probably goes out to a little bit, like 2 more inches that way.
But that's 20,000 milliamp hours?
Yep.
So how many days did that take to charge?
Not days. Not at all. But it does power a Raspberry Pi all day long.
I bet it does. I bet it does. Yes. So is that meant for your backpack rig? Is that why you bought that? Okay.
Yep. So I've also used it to charge Nexus 5, Nexus 7, and another phone at the same time.
Sure.
It was kind of ridiculous, but yeah, this sucker is a beast. I charged 3 devices at least to full, and it still had juice in the tank.
Nice.
So I was just like, okay, yeah. I got a smaller version of this that now I just use just for my phones and other peripherals, and I saved this puppy for my backpack rig, and love it.
So I admit that I carry around the crush-proof ones from it started as a Kickstarter. It's Zendure, or it's the word endure with a Z in front of it, Zendure. And I'm very fond of their products because they have pretty darn decent charging circuitry. And their Gritter 1 is a nice small 85 or 8900 milliamp hour, very small, easily fits inside one of the pockets of the vest and allows me to continue charging and using my device all freaking day. Now, if I don't care about weight requirements, I go for the crush-proof ones that they make, the A and or the B, model B of their products, and I just get 10 and 12,000, I think, no, 15,000 milliamp hours, or there's now even a larger one that I think is 18,000 milliamp hours and actually has a digital readout on the front, like a bright red LED readout, actually. It's pretty amazing, but it's not light when you get into the largest version of it, but I mean, if you want on the go and you're one of these EDC, you know, everyday carry folk, you probably find some rechargeable battery to put in there to help round out your set so that you are not suddenly, stuck. So as Coop is well aware, I'm fond of a certain smaller Dell Venue 8, tablet as a go-between convergence device. So it's actually intended for me to be able to run full up Windows 10. And it runs like like a Samsung tablet. So it actually just uses one USB port and I can charge out of that. Now the trick is you use Bluetooth keyboard and mouse on it and it becomes a full blown PC. My goal at the time was to be completely wireless. This was back when you actually still had cellular, internet services that provided their own standalone routers and access points and modem dongles and the whole thing, which are now pretty much kind of obviated by just cell phones. But the point is, and I know I'm old. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I want to talk about. Get off my digital lawn. Yes. So in this rant about wanting to actually be able to be off the grid and actually just operating with a solar pack, a solar charger, and the ability to run everything off of that, the idea would be that if I ever went camping, everyone says, well, I go camping to get away from it all. And I said, if you make me go camping, I'm bringing it with me. And so I'm going to actually be the person who's actually out there with the actual charging plates. I'm basically going to be trying to cook the birds as they fly overhead, so that I can charge all of my devices and have connectivity. If there's a way I can do it, I'll probably add a second screen to the side of the RV or tent that I'm operating so that I can actually, basically one step away from the character that, Randy Quaid was playing in Independence Day, the original one. Yeah, as the chat room is attempting to make me smile as I try to talk my way through this, it was actually, there was a point here, which was the idea of being able to use clothing that charges devices. If you've ever had a device charging in your pocket while you were using it, did you notice how hot they get? It's not necessarily comfortable to be wearing a space heater. Just keep that in mind next time you want to use your device in like runkeeper mode and then have a battery plugged into it. Aside from the fact that, you know, it's trying to drag your clothing to the ground, the reality is that these devices get really warm and there's not enough room for insulation. So, anyway, I would like to move us to a strange story here in Gadget Prawn. Because occasionally it crosses the line into, what am I reading again? And this kind of borders on that. This story from Gizmodo.com says, if you've ever enjoyed a horror movie that involves an organ, that involved organ harvesting, you may be pleased to know that scientists are one step closer to using organic matter to power robots. Sea slugs are getting first honors. Scientists from Case Western Reserve University took a sea slug's mouth muscle and attached it to a 2-inch 3D printed part to make a biohybrid robot. When shocked using electricity, the muscle helps the hybrid crawl forward, though at the not very quick speed of just 0.4 centimeters a minute. We're creating a robot that can manage different tasks than an animal or a purely man-made robot could, said doctoral candidate Victoria Quinn, who's leading this research. Sea slugs are adaptable to different temperatures, and the soft muscle cells are safer to operate than hard parts. You can't make this up. And the reality is that we're actually now cutting things off of other things to make things that move when we ask them to move things. I'm getting confused just saying it. I'm also concerned about what's going on in our chat room that I'm thankful that no one else can see right now. Because that's just a little bit odd. They're trying to say that, look, in the future, these biohybrid robots could be used for search missions in the ocean. Between this 3D printed sea slug and the Stingray robot that's fueled from light activated cells from rat hearts, one day we could have an entire fleet of cyborg animals doing our bidding. I've been waiting for Coop to explode with Skynet discussions. Instead, I'm getting things I can't repeat out loud out of our chat room.
It just befuddles me that, you know, this art description of the use of the cyborg parts, that they're using a mouth muscle to crawl forward. Can it not go backwards? Can it go sideways?
It's like Zoolander. It can't turn left. It's just Zoolander, okay? One day we'll be able to overcome this, but not now. Instead, I'd actually like to turn from the extremely odd to an interesting story from howtogeek.com. That's howtogeek.com, which is actually how to use a USB key to unlock a BitLocker encrypted PC. Now, this seems like maybe something that you've already done or walked through, but for a lot of folks, they haven't actually started using some of these higher functioning encrypted features built into operating systems. So if you would like to enable BitLocker encryption, and Windows will automatically unlock your drive each time you start up your computer using the TPM, that's the Trusted Platform Module, that's built into most modern computers. So you can set up any USB flash drive as the startup key that must be presented at boot time before your computer can decrypt its drive and then start up Windows. This effectively adds two-factor authentication to BitLocker encryption, according to the article. I may reserve judgment on whether or not that's actually considered a two-factor solution. Granted, the drive counts as external USB drive counts as one thing you have, and the other factor is something you know. No, it just says that if I'm in physical possession of this key and I provide it to the computer, that doesn't sound quite like two-factor, but aside from getting into an argument over that, it says whenever you start your computer, you'll need to provide the USB key before it will be decrypted. This would be a particularly useful feature with small USB drives that you can carry on a keychain. Now, I will suggest that if you're going to consider something like that, you consider a YubiKey or some similar device that actually is capable of holding digital certificates and other things, but that's more than this article supports. What's very interesting, though, is that this walks you through step by step with the basics of how to enable BitLocker on a PC so you can turn on this encryption if it is not already turned on, and then how to use this Trusted Platform Module, which is a physically gapped or separated cryptographic module embedded in the motherboard that actually allows you to store security certificates, digital certificates, keys, so that we can actually kind of have a launch key mechanism, right? So it's actually locking the key inside a box and then locking the box inside another box. And so you have to pass one key to the first box to unlock the private key, which is kept inside the other box, in order to use it to launch the encryption, or rather the decryption process, to get your system running. And this goes in, the article goes into much better detail of how to functionally get this done and how to set it up. Now, if you're going to use an actual USB key, realize that even standard USB keys can be hacked at the firmware level and then presented as a risk. So you may want to consider something else. There's a product called an iron key. So the iron key uses encryption in your USB device and is protected. And you can pick up an 8 gig drive for the whopping simple low price of $140. No, not cheap. So if you can find a similar device that is less expensive, you may want to go with it, because the whole idea is I want to protect the thing that's protecting my key. So if someone else can root and do mean things to my USB drive, how can I trust the data on the USB drive? Because, again, the protection has to go all the way down to protecting your junk. And I'm referring to your computer files, people. This is the entire point. Stick with me here. I'm serious. This is the moment where you have to realize that even the USB firmware can be tampered with. So how do you trust what you have? And the idea is sometimes that costs more. In the same way that the locks in our houses are susceptible to bump keys, if you really want to never sleep again, look up bump keys and how easy it is to use those on YouTube, and then decide that you're going to spend $75 or $120 instead of the $15 one lock that was on sale at your local home improvement store. And then come back and tell me why it isn't worth spending $50, $75, $100 if you're serious about your security. Look, just setting this up alone is worth the effort. If you go to the trouble and steps of setting up these things, meaning drive encryption and a launch key on a separate thumb drive that you trust, that is a huge set of steps, and that works. That's good. Meanwhile, if that doesn't work enough well enough for you, there are other options. So, even if that doesn't work for you, if you're really going to be concerned about your security, you can take it further, is all I'm really saying. I'm only trying to suggest to you that there are more options that we have available to us if we want to go further. You don't have to. Nothing requires you to. But that's okay. In other news, Coop is going to talk to us about law enforcement unlocking a dead man's iPhone by 3D printing something. Let's see what happens.
Yep. According to the hackernews.com, police are unlocked a dead man's phone by 3D printing his fingerprint. Now, no more fight with Apple or any smartphone maker, as federal authorities have discovered new tool for unlocking phones. As far as your phone is using any biometric sensor, it's now 3D printed.
Wow.
Yes, police in Michigan is considering 3D printing a dead man's fingers so they can unlock smartphones in investigating crimes using biometric sensors. No, this isn't a scene out of CSI Cyber. It's a new report published from Flash Forward creator Rose Evelyn revealed that the police recently approached professors at the University of Michigan to reproduce a dead man's fingerprint from a pre-recorded scan.
Interesting.
Once reproduced, the 3D print could be used to create a false fingerprint of the dead man, which could then be used to unlock his smartphone using its biometric sensors. The man was a murder victim, and law enforcement investigators believe that his phone might contain some useful information relevant to the case. So what does that make y'all think? This 3D printing technology, as it would be, is just that much cooler indeed, right?
Well, I mean, can't they just start with a gummy bear? I mean, there's a reason they called it the gummy bear attack originally. Couldn't they? Why go to all the trouble of trying to print with a filament or plasticized substance if I can just use a gelatin-based something and get ridges that works? So I'm not sure that it's worth going to all that trouble, because you're still going to have to provide a thin enough layer a membrane, essentially. It's not even going to be a standalone fingerprint. There are reasons this isn't going to work outright without some kind of tweaks to it, I thought. Pinky, have you ever tried to use the gummy bear to unlock something just for funsies?
No, I haven't, but I guess I tangent is, so one of my friends has an iPhone as well with the, you know, fingerprints, you know, unlock. He found out that his wife, if he holds her thumb, you know, just on the very tip of the scanner, then it will sometimes unlock. Like,
really?
It's like 2 out of 12 tries, which I know is a low probability, but that's still enough if you have someone's phone to start messing with and try to get into the phone. So I think this just comes down to is that our, unless you're paying a lot of money for, you know, the fingerprint scan or whatnot, then it's not going to be all that accurate. You know, there's some sort of threshold they have to reach. So using a 3D printer to hit that threshold isn't that bad.
And I wonder how hard it is to reproduce some of these vulnerabilities. Coop, have you heard? I know you've heard of some stories. I'm looking at some of the information in the chat window.
I remember when the first iPhone to get a fingerprint sensor, article hit really quick that people were able to proof of concept that, you know, it wasn't very good. Like just a Xerox copy of somebody's fingerprint was able to, you know, unlock the phone. And yeah, it wasn't a gummy bear that you've been watching too much leverage. It was a gummy frog.
Oh, excuse
Arson
me.
Totally used that to unlock a safe in one of the things. But it also, you know, think further, you know, if you really want to go with CSI Cyber, where they pull the skin off the guy's finger and then hold it over their own finger to unlock a computer in that show. But 3D printing fingers, that just sounds fun to me.
Well, sure.
It might just be because, well, I recently got a 3D printer not that long ago and I've started playing with it myself.
Well, so have you tried
using... Are you printing fingers?
Yeah, yes, there you go.
No, I haven't tried 3D printing my fingers yet. I'm not that much of a goober. But I've already tried modifying my M3D so that it'll have a heated bed, as I was warned about that it didn't have it before I got it. But hey, the price was right at the time. And that modification, though has not been fully tested, has still been tested by others and seems to help with the delamination issue where everything lifts no matter how much you glue it down.
And do we know if, I mean, the article suggested that they might have trouble getting the print to actually read. Do we know if the biometric sensor on the phone is looking for life behind it, or is it only looking for ridges? Do we know?
I don't think we do know, and I don't know if we will know easily.
Look at the article again, see, because, you know, like you mentioned, some fingerprint sensors out there still, you know, notice electricity and heat behind the fingerprint itself. It's not just the thing. And yeah, looks like here.
It does mention it. Yeah,
it mentions electricity here. In turn, made the police approach Professor Jane, who told Fusion that he coated the 3D printed fingers in a 3D thin layer of metallic particles.
Yep.
So they could conduct electricity. The fingerprint scanner can then read them.
Interesting.
So, but it doesn't talk about heat, just electricity.
So according to this Engadget article from September of 2013, unless Pinky, did you already have one up?
No.
Okay, so this article from 2013 from Engadget says that there are certain things regarding their Touch ID that are required to make it work. So the iPhone 5S utilized two methods to sense and identify a fingerprint. It's capacitive, which is activated by the slight electrical charge running through your skin, and we all have a small amount of current running through our bodies, and capacitive technology utilizes that to sense touch. It's the same tech used in the touch screen to detect input. The other is RF, and our radio frequency. So RF waves do not respond to the dead layer of skin on the outside of your finger, the part that might be chapped or too dry to be read with much accuracy, and instead reads only the living tissue underneath. producing an extremely precise image of your fingerprint, and ensuring that a severed finger would be completely useless. So this means that the Touch ID sensor should be remarkably accurate for living creatures, but means that only a finger attached to a beating heart will be able to unlock it. So should someone run up to you, hack off your finger, grab your phone, and attempt to unlock it, there's virtually no chance that's going to work. That's according to an article from 2013. That's all directly from the article. Very, very curious. Wondering if how far they're going to get that. So, meanwhile, back at the ranch...
Well, as Pinky said in the chat, remember, you can always change your passwords if it's stolen, but you can't change your fingerprints.
That's a very, very interesting story to end our segment on Gadget Prawn, and instead we're going to talk about some apps here in the App Attic, opening up with a story from another story from Coop.
All right, let me switch over to that screen real quick. And yeah, it's an Ars Technica story, once again. And the headline is, Sex Offender Arrested, Accused of Playing Pokemon Go with Kids. When it's no longer safe to play Pokemon, I guess. And the story of an Indiana man, however, the takes a cake. The case of a 42-year-old Randy, not going to say his last name, comes in as our top vote for Dumbest Criminal of the Month. And it gets... our top vote for strangest Pokemon Go story would definitely get mine, too. We've heard the following mobile apps debut last week. So this individual, he's a registered child sex offender. In April, he pleaded guilty to a felony charge of fondling a 14-year-old and was placed on sex offender probation for 4 years. The terms include him not interacting with children and as a probation officer allegedly saw him playing Pokemon Go with children outside the Hancock County Courthouse, a site highlighted in the game that is drawing players to the vicinity. The probation department, which is monitoring Zurich, this individual, is housed at the courthouse. So he was then arrested and is expected to appear in court where a judge could consider revoking his probation, and the courthouse is about 25 miles east of Indianapolis. Wow. Is that, I'm kind of lost for words here. What's a reaction from you guys?
Well, this does bring up a good point on these more interactive games. And I'm not defending him here. Do not let that come as what I'm saying when I'm about to say this. But if you're just playing a game on your phone that requires you to go outside, and maybe you don't pay attention as you should if you're on probation, and before you know it, you're in front of some kids, and all you think is, oh shit. But possibly at that point in time, you're already screwed. So it does bring up the point of, maybe as a safety mechanism for parents or whatever, how do you verify that your kids, if you let them go out and play Pokemon Go, 15, 14-year-olds, whatever, how do you make sure they don't get into the vicinity of a, sex offender as well?
Very interesting concern, because this is a game. It's gotten people up off the couch. Now that it's popular, because it's popular, it attracts all sorts of folks. Unfortunately, the phrase "it takes all kinds" covers a whole range of topics. And in the case of a commercialized opportunity, you're going to get some folks who try to take advantage. Unfortunately, the internet already made jokes about the dangers of just running around into dark alleys chasing Pokemon. We need to be careful, folks. Please, oh please, pay attention to where you are. Pay attention to your surroundings. Consider the concept called OPSEC. Okay? So it's great that you want to get fantastic scores in your favorite games. And it's great that it gets us off the couch and gets us to be active and go out and to actually interact with other players. But please, we may joke about it a little bit, but stranger danger, people, it's not always a joke. It's not funny. Bad things happen. Please, by all means, be aware of your surroundings. Remain aware of your surroundings. If something doesn't look right, if it doesn't pass your personal sniff test, get out of there. Bring friends, lots of friends that you trust. If, you know, if you can't sleep, you know, it's not always a good time to go out into an open field or into that dark alley. Maybe bring a large crowd of people that you trust with you, or just don't go there. Sadly, this is the state of things, that people will take advantage. But rest assured, there are other stories that we are going to cover that will probably scare us even more. But this next story probably won't, as we ask Pinky to tell us about Windows 10.
Yeah, this one definitely won't scare you, and it probably won't surprise you. This article is from BossBytes.com, where the title is, Windows 10 is a Failure, According to Microsoft's Own Metric. And the short gist of it is that Microsoft has accepted that Windows 10 has failed to perform as expected. The software giant hopes that by mid-2018, Windows 10 will be running on 1 billion devices. Now this seems far-fetched due to the constantly shrinking PC market and poor performance of Windows 10 Mobile. And, you know, the article does go into how, you know, you only have till a few days from now to get Windows 10 for free. And, you know, Windows 10 is the most advanced operating system for Microsoft as of yet. And they were hoping, of course, by 2018 to hit 1 billion installations. I think it was interesting that Microsoft had bet so much on Windows 10 Mobile that they would incorporate that in their numbers. I'm honestly a bit surprised that they didn't separate the numbers and say, hey, we hope PC-wise that this is the number we're aiming for, because Microsoft has, you know, accepted that the PC market is shrinking, which is why they're trying so hard with, you know, the Windows phone and all the other tablets, you know, to try to assert themselves in the market that way. So honestly, this isn't all that surprising that they haven't failed. You know, the phone, as we, I think, mentioned in a previous week, is a failure at this point in time. It doesn't have Pokemon Go, so come on.
Nice. But I mean, let's look at the real situation. You hit the nail on the head, as you described, by including the supposed growth, or the hopeful growth, of the Windows Mobile market, which unfortunately has not materialized. I still have high hopes for the concept that they talked about, a convergence concept that's called Continuum, which basically turns the mobile phone into a desktop PC when you're connected that way, which is what the Ubuntu phone had touted when it attempted to make itself known several years ago now, and helped, Indiegogo become, kind of get their name on the, out there and get on the map. So they were trying to raise $10 million and they got as far as raising $2 million. But the same kind of idea, where if I could have a device that would be my phone when I'm in phone mode, but then if I plug it into a desktop keyboard, mouse, and monitor, I could use a get it more desktop like experience and get some work done. So Windows Mobile in Windows 10 Mobile promised to deliver this kind of experience, which I thought would be fantastic. Unfortunately, it took longer than expected to get them out. There is not the preponderance of devices. You've only got a couple or three. There's, as we've already described, there are other shortcomings like a lack of third-party apps to really go for. It just makes it very difficult to continue on that platform without that kind of acceptance and kind of an, you know, just it's used everywhere. Well, not so much. But it has a very decent browser. It's got a very decent, fast experience on the mobile device. It's just not as thorough as it could be. So I don't know if you've ever used Windows Mobile in the Windows 7, Windows Phone 7, Windows Phone 8, or 10 experiences, but I just haven't found enough to suggest that we're going to get there in the time they want. And the article even suggests it's going to get all the way to, I think it's around 2020. Isn't that what it says there, Pinky?
I believe so, yeah. But honestly, I'm not so surprised on this. I mean, I've played with the Windows phones in like the Microsoft Store. It is an enjoyable experience, but it's so different from Android or iPhone that you're not going to get people who are just like, well, I want a cheaper alternative, because one, it's not really all that cheaper. And, you know, you're going to Windows, which has a bad reputation with most people. Welcome to being, you know, the dominant number one on PC. You just get a bad reputation due to your security vulnerabilities and, you know, Vista, thanks for tarnishing Microsoft's reputation forever. You know, things like that. And it's just, I don't know if the market is ready for an integration between, you know, your mobile device and your computer. I don't think they're ready for that continuum, you know. Apple's been slowly transitioning to it. They've been hinting at it, but they never go fully there. And then when we've seen attempts to go for it, you know, you might need either a device that ends up not looking very nice, you know, UI, from a UI perspective, mm-hmm. or it's too expensive, and I'm sorry, I don't believe my smartphone should cost as much as I could get for a computer. And I'm not saying, like, the crappy little netbooks or Chromebooks, because, you know, your phone probably performs better than those do. But when you start getting to the fact that some people pay $800, and I'm not even talking unlocked, you know, just the more expensive Android phones being $600-$800 with contract at times for your phone, then you're getting to the point of, well, I could get a cheap PC for pretty good for that, you know. You're getting into this mix of, sure, the PC market is dying, but there will always be a place for it. It's going to go on a downward spiral to a bit and then probably plateau and start increasing again. That's just my two cents here.
I do wonder about that. Coop, what's your thought before I go and get back on the soapbox?
Yeah, well, that's one thing I love and hate about Apple is that their ecosystem plays nice. But I want that kind of functionality on Android, too. But furthermore, I want it to play nice with Linux. Come on.
Android is Linux.
Well,
it is.
It's a form of, but it doesn't play nice.
Are you saying it's like the Wonder Twins? Is it the form of a bucket of water? You're saying it's just not the it's not the cool one? It happens to be
defeated by an evil sponge. I'm saying it's unfortunately, you know, in comparison to the way the ecosystem works with Apple, you know, even down to most often, you know, Apple TV, MacBook, iPhone, iPad, all playing nice and transferring equally throughout this evil little sphere, I would like that to work too. I would like my Linux computer to talk to my Android phone and be able to sync as easily. But without the proprietary, you know, framework.
Yeah, but that's not even okay. So the part of the challenge with a convergence, I've argued this for several years. So Pinky says, I don't think the market's ready for that, and Apple hasn't gotten there, and I don't think Apple wants to get there. Apple wants you to have a MacBook Air, and they want you to have an iPad, or an iPhone, or both, or all three. Whatever sells more. But realistically, their attempt to get back at Microsoft for actually succeeding with the Surface tablets is the iPad Pro, which remarkably, wow, what do you mean you brought out a desktop powerful tablet that truly is meant to do real work on when it's basically just, I mean, who would have ever imagined that a device like that would have apps that are so deeply more useful? In what world is it that the mobile space is where we're going to do the heaviest work? I thought the whole idea, if we go back and look at something like the Apple Newton, like the Palm Pilot, yes, I said Palm Pilot, the idea was you do the heavy lifting out the desktop, and you take your reference device with you and run out the door. Because if you want to take notes, you can actually do other things. You can tinker on your mobile device, but it's not meant to be your workhorse. It's not a desktop replacement. So now we're getting to a point where we actually have the iPad Pro, which guys who love Apple devices, let's cite one like Steve Gibson, who runs the Security Now podcast, said that it was so large he didn't feel comfortable toting it from place to place. So you've obviously, as a manufacturer, got to wonder, at what point do people not want this device? Theoretically, they don't want to lug it from place to place, right? That was the problem with a laptop. That's why tablets took off, isn't it? Or isn't it something else? So maybe if we look at the size of the device, Apple responded to the success of the Nexus 7, an inexpensive tablet device, by coming out with the iPad Mini. At least that's the argument as I heard it. Take with this, look at this other concept. I want to go and see if there's something else on the market. What else can I get? I'm going to pause, take a breath for a second, because my thoughts are starting to run in different directions. Take the floor.
So, Art Coop, do you want to go first?
No, ladies first.
Okay, so first things first, I have a fundamental disagreement with you saying that the, you know, iPad Pro is a response to the, you know, Surface Book Pro. Because first, the Surface Book Pro came as a respondent. I know they said it was competing with the, you know, MacBook Pro, but let's be honest, everyone knew that was not the case. You just don't get that same power. It was actually a response to the original iPad because no one was able to touch the market share of the original iPad. For the price you could get, the convenience you could get, the apps and how it played well with Apple, and, you know, Apple's really good in their ecosystem. If you have a Mac, you're going to like the iPhone, you're going to like the iPad, et cetera, et cetera. That's not the point I'm trying to go here, is that the iPad was really the revolutionary tablet, and since then, people have been trying to play catch-up and do one-up on the iPad. And the Surface Book Pro did a good job on that. They got into this nice little, you know, niche area that Coop mentioned of, you know, full operating system versus mobile. The Surface Book Pro did a good job of going to that in-between of, here's a tablet that can do your full operating system. The price is a little high still, and that's why, you know, iPad and the Surface Book Pro became separate markets, because the iPad was always going to be cheaper because the Surface Book Pro could do the full operating system features. And I've seen people use them. I love the Surface Book Pro. I love how it really is one of the few that can do a computer and a tablet in one. Its pen is natural. It's just very intuitive, especially for a PhD student. A few of them have them, of how they do their notes. I like the iPad Pro. Do I think it's necessarily a market? No. Do I think it's going to compete with the Surface Book Pro? No, and I don't think they're quite going for it. They seem to still be emphasizing on the people who want to stay in the Apple market, that want a bit more powerful, a bigger screen in some cases, and just be able to do a bit more. Yes, I think they're trying to finally, I think Apple has realized that the iPad is never going to fully replace a computer like maybe they originally intended when they first started it. There's no tablet out there, I would argue, that can. So I think they're trying to catch on a market that's like, look, I don't necessarily need the full features of a computer. Maybe I don't need a game. Maybe I don't need to do these features. But, I mean, Apple has had a long line of capturing a lot of the, you know, photographers, the artsy type people, you know, the drawers. And I think that's where the iPad Pro came in, is that you can start doing Photoshop. You can draw really nicely if you spend the extra $200 on their pencil, which is nice, but really $200 for a pencil that I'm going to lose. You got me there, Apple. That annoys me. But, you know, they're trying to catch into a different ecosystem, I believe, than Microsoft. I think they're doing similar, but different enough that while there'll be slight competition, maybe, I don't think there's going to be a full-fledged war like Windows versus Mac or Android versus iPhone, for example.
All right, Coop, you're up.
Yeah. Now, you talk about full, you know, not being able to compete with tablet. Well, then I'd have to say, how do you define a tablet? Is a tablet just an iPad where it's just the screen all contained in one, kind of like a UMPC of old? Or are you then going further, talking about like a Surface or, you know, something else, you know, that, you know, will either bend back on itself like a gymnast, hiding the keyboard so that you can use it like an iPad, it's a wannabe iPad, or you're talking like the Surface Book, which I have drilled over sciatics, when it detaches the screen, but it loses its GPU then. Come on. That's half of the sexiness of the thing, is the GPU on a laptop. I want that functionality on, MacBooks in the future, and to go past 16 gig of RAM. Are you kidding, Apple? How do you justify charging that much for a laptop when you don't go past 16 gig of RAM? When I can find a Dell or a ThinkPad with 64 gig of RAM. Oh my gosh. Power. But they're still not a GPU. I want all the power. I want the GPU. I want it small and portable. I would love that to be in the form of like a MacBook Air one day, 12 inches or less. I could fit it into, my man purse, which is a satchel, and I could go on and take on the world. Yes, it's a satchel. And no, I don't have a man purse, but I do want small form factor with all the power if I'm going to be spending as much as Apple makes me spend. It's like, come on. That's why, you know, unfortunately, I haven't bought a new Mac in, was it 6 years now?
Yeah.
So, Coop, I'm going to go with this, is that with an Apple, you don't necessarily buy just for the hardware, because I will always concede this point. If you're just looking for pure hardware, you shouldn't go for a Mac. You should go for a PC, even, not even a goddamn laptop. Because with a PC, you can keep upgrading continuously, and it once you get limited on the RAM, you can wait for the next cycle, get a new motherboard, get a new processor, get more RAM, et cetera, et cetera. PC's where you want if you just want pure power, in my opinion.
But for me, power you get portability.
Power and portability, you're getting into a weird place there, because even Windows laptops, there's only so much you can upgrade, and what's always going to kill you is that goddamn video card. So, the problem is that a lot of video cards on laptops are integrated, and there's no way to, easy way to replace them unless you replace the whole motherboard, therefore defeating the purpose, and you might as well go get a goddamn new laptop at that point.
So I got to jump in here and actually push a different point. So depending on what you're looking for will or should help guide your choice. End of story. If your goal is to say, I need to do work, choose the right object. If you are looking for a squat and surf device, because look, the reality is humans do it. We're going to sit down and we're going to want a moment or two to look through, whether it's Reddit or our funny video clip website, something. We're going to sit, we're going to dig through stuff. A consumption device like a tablet is perfect for that. And I want to sit in bed at night and I want to look through stuff. A laptop is a pain to do that with sometimes, depending on the size. So maybe the netbook is the perfect form factor in that case. Or if you've got a Surface Book, you can just detach and use the clipboard mode. But I got news for you. That clipboard, now you've got to be really careful, because there is nothing so sensitive as that clipboard, because it is, there's no protection. There's no case. There's no, you drop it, you're done. So there are all these other things that you can do with it, but it's a trade-off, right? There's always a trade-off, which is why I absolutely love the idea of the 8-inch tablet. That's why the Dell Venue Pro was my choice a year to 2 years ago, because it is the convergence between something that's light enough to hold in your hands, that you can stick a case on, that'll let me do everything up to and including, because it had 2 gigs of RAM, I can actually virtualize a lightweight Linux operating system. And that's what I would do. I would run, with VMware Player, I would actually run a lightweight XFCE desktop on it. Why? So that I could, because there was room to do it. And it has a micro SD card slot, which is up to 128 gigs of expansion, which I don't get on either a Google-produced tablet or an iPad. The iPad comes with whatever size you get. You're locked in. I don't always want that, because maybe I can't afford $700 to get the latest version of that tablet. But I can buy this full Windows 10 running thing on an 8-inch platform for under $300. Now, there are trade-offs. But I'm using a full Windows operating system, so install Chrome, all your apps, and get a desktop experience. Well, how am I going to do that? It's a 2-inch freaking screen, or an 8-inch freaking screen. The answer is you can use a wireless external video adapter, and then it will mirror your device, and you can have the full screen experience that way, and then you just drive it with a simple finger, and you can do it that way. Or there's even a docking station, not like a little knockoff one. You get it from Pluggable, the guys who make the awesome USB hubs, and it turns this 8-inch tablet into a full-blown desktop computer. The box stands up on a little stand next to the tablet and plugs into it using the one simple micro USB port it has, allows you to charge the device and expand it to an additional 4 USB ports and an external monitor, and has an external sound card. So now you've taken a sub-$300 tablet and turns it into a full-blown desktop. Doesn't mean it's going to be a crappy full-blown desktop. Yeah, don't expect it to do everything. But by all means, as a convergence device, it goes and does a lot of things pretty well. I'm not saying it's going to be your Steam box. That would be insane. No graphics, no massive GPU. But Apple's not known for that anyway. Go ask Apple users.
Well, I'm going to argue with you there. MacBook Pro Retina has, I think it's either 1 or 2 gig separate graphics card that I have in the one I'm using right now.
Oh, wow.
Along with the built-in Intel, you know, graphics 4000 or whatever. That way, that's one of the things about the Retina line is that it was designed for both photographers, video editors, and gamers because you have that separate graphics card that it switches to when it needs it.
Okay, I sit corrected. I sit corrected. Very well.
They are starting to address that with laptops because they acknowledge the fact that, you know, Macs are fucking expensive. I will give you that. I got lucky. Yeah. I got this as a graduation present. And, you know, if it breaks, I'm probably going to have to replace it with the Windows one, which would break my heart.
No, no, your left kidney. You would just have to give up a kidney.
Yeah, I need that also for my PhD program. And along with my soul, I'm saving that for bargaining down the road.
Wow.
After I have my dissertation, then we'll talk. But, you know, Macs are expensive, and it does irritate me that with this line also is when they dealt with the whole, you can't upgrade your RAM anymore. It's soldered in.
What kind of decision-making process was that?
I'm telling you that was. If you look at the inside, they were trying to make this thinner and quieter. I can run, you know, whatever game that would normally have the fans going super loud, and it is very quiet. It doesn't heat up much. They were looking into the aerodynamics, the cooling, and things like that, and how to make it thin, and the battery last a long time. Part of that sacrifice was no longer to be able to upgrade it yourself, and like the battery's now built in as well. And it's annoying when you're a tech user, but when you're a normal end user and you just want performance power without the speed or the heat, it makes sense. There has to be a trade-off when you want it to be so thin.
Well, there you have it. All right. I guess that makes sense. I don't know that I love it, but I understand it.
I love this laptop. It does irritate me, the lack of upgradability. But I'm willing to do that trade-off. But okay. I think we've hit this, you know, we beat this horse enough times. So let's just end this with, remember, guys, Coop wants 12 inches or less.
Oh, dear Lord.
Oh, thank you so much for that.
Yeah.
Yes, I want a small laptop, lots of RAM, GPU, nice resolution. But I can't find it. I find the resolution I want on the new 13-inch Dell XPS. It's got the resolution to fit all the world on your screen and read it all in tiny, tiny print. The ThinkPad mobile workstation that has 64 gig of RAM and an extra video card on top of it. So, yes, it doesn't then share the RAM. And, you know, but I'd love it to be small enough to basically fit in one day, hopefully, the old P-Series Sony Vaio. That would be lovely, because it would be smaller than a Nexus 7 and yet have all the power and love to share the internets with me.
And all the proprietary love of an Apple product as well. But, you know, because Sony is, having owned one Sony laptop product, actually getting to use it. I didn't even own it. I was allowed to operate it. Everything that you wanted to get for this thing cost about cost about $1 billion, and you had to special order it. But maybe that's changed. Who knows? I'm going to drag us sideways with another article, because that's what we do here. And, it's going to be from Wired.com. And it's a service that alerts you when someone else is using your social security number. So you already know that identity theft can happen to anybody, and you're never more than a few headlines away from another wide-scale hack. But what are you supposed to do with this knowledge? According to a new service called Civic, the answer is simple. Track your social security number. Civic, which bills itself as an identity protection network and launches in beta on the 19th of July, it hinges on a simple enough premise. If your social security number gets used, you will get a push notification. That's it. We think about the way you secure your information is not by keeping it private, it's about being able to follow its use, says Civic's co-founder and CEO Vinny Lingam. So that's an interesting idea. It's a free service, and if you sign up, you get $1 million of identity theft insurance as long as you're using the app. There's always an open, there's an always open helpline if you get into an identity theft quagmire. And if the company, that's strange. So, and if the company where the fraud occurred pays to partner with Civic, you'll have the option to cancel transactions before they actually go through. And that last part is how Civic is planning to pay its bills. So, this is a really interesting idea. I think that that's actually what we need, is a way to track our incident handling methods, right? So if you are going to engage in living in this world that requires sharing of information at some level, maybe this is the right thing to do. Maybe having this as a monitoring service will help. Pinky, do you think you would sign up for a service that actively watches for hits on your social?
Well, thanks to the OPM hack, I already have a service that does this.
Ah.
Because it does let me know when someone's using my social security number. However, I do have a concern when it comes down to, you provide your social security number to a service for free for tracking. What are they doing in return for the $1 million credit protection? Is it going to be shit? Are you never going to get anything from it? What are they doing with your information for free? Because that doesn't make sense. That's why I don't use free credit tracking websites or any of that, because it's, what are you doing with my information?
Mm-hmm. Well, and are they just setting themselves up to become the next target, right? Isn't that a concern?
Yeah, why not? Because, I mean, you're publicizing and you're becoming popular. They, hey, we can provide you real-time notification about all this. So it's like, well, should I now aim for you if I'm a hacker and I want all those social security numbers? And then you can go alert that, hey, we lost your social security number, and here's an alert that they're trying to use it. There you go.
Well, so, Coop, were you part of the OPM hack? Do you have a service you're currently using? Would you like to be let known if someone is just accessed or made use of your social?
Yeah, I am a part of the OPM hack, unfortunately. And even if you just go through just a security clearance check, don't even finish it, you are a part of it. And thankfully, yes, they give you that information to protect yourself, but, you know, it just makes me wonder, just like every other thing the government buys, you know, the lowest price isn't always the best one. So just because they got the cheapest bid for the service, it just makes me nervous, especially since it is my identity involved. And, you know, since that got hacked, it's like, what's going to be the fallout on that? Even though, yeah, much like every other student out there that has student loans, my credit's crap. They got nothing when they got me, but it just makes me concerned for those people out there that it probably could do some serious damage to.
Well, we all need to be, especially after this episode, concerned about privacy, and I think that we are going to probably not see the end of that concern anytime soon. And there's an awareness that needs to come up in everybody's minds. It's not that you shouldn't leave the house. It's not that we're trying to say hide under the bed. We're saying, look, be aware of how things interoperate. Be aware of how stuff moves and what data, or what is being done with your data. So keep that in mind whenever conducting yourself. And just like if your parents ever said, be careful when you talk to other people and get invited back, this is the same idea. Know who is taking advantage of your data, what they're doing with it if you can. And if for no other reason than taking things up a notch, learn about the way things work so that you have better awareness. It's part of better InfoSec and better OpSec. And that's, I think, a worthwhile pursuit. Thanks again.
Also,
oh, yes.
Yeah, sorry, but just one last comment is, even if you're not technologically savvy or you know someone who isn't, just remember that nothing's free in this world. Everything comes at a price. So when you see things like, I mean, just think about your Facebook and you see the people who share those stupid things of, you know, sign up with your email to get a free $250 gift card at your local grocery store. And you always notice how after that they might start sharing some weird Facebook posts because they've probably been hacked. Just think about that. Nothing comes free. That's just crappy, and that's part of life.
And on that note, we want to thank you so much for listening to us trample through these stories. Thank you for going deep into the weeds with us this week, and please feel free to reach out to us with questions or comments. And just a heads up again, as Coop mentioned earlier, we will be on hiatus until the 14th of August, what with all the security happenings coming up in Las Vegas in the next week or so. If you happen to be in Vegas and you see one of us, not that you know what we would look like, but if you've listened to the program and you're interested in getting an interview with us so we can actually put you on the air in a future episode, please stop us and catch up with us, probably using the SATX Hackers account there on Twitter. So please catch up with us there, and next time we might be willing to talk with you about security. Thank you very much.